Hello and welcome to Avasant on the Record. My name is Sebastian Sobolev, and I'm joined by Doug Berenson, a managing director here at Avasant, and Matt Vallone, our director of research and analysis within the analytics division. Both have published widely on defense spending, both from the perspective of the budget process and from the perspective of actual spending trends. Today we wanted to offer a few preliminary thoughts on a story that broke yesterday in the Washington Post. That story described a report in which the Defense Business Board found that the Pentagon spends lavishly on back office functions, and notably, that it has the potential to save around $125 billion over essentially the future year's defense plan through various efficiencies. So Doug, since you published a study on O&M spending early last year, we'll start with you. Are you surprised by anything you read yesterday?
No, I'm really not, honestly. I think if you look at the way the Defense Department is organized, and how it has been resistant to internal efficiencies over the decades, this doesn't come as a surprise at all. I think the Defense Department is in many ways, I think of it almost like an archaeological site where it you have layer upon layer of accumulated human endeavor piling up over the centuries, and that's essentially what you have in the Defense Department, is you have the accumulation of decisions and policies and programs and practices, and it's very, very difficult to get rid of any of them. And so they build on top of each other. You have reforms on top of reforms, and it tends to accumulate in people and cost. And I think that is essentially in summation, largely the dynamic that the Washington Post uncovered. I and others, I think, have long talked about the potential cost savings that might be available from substantial consolidation in the Defense Department, and DoD itself obviously has long wanted further infrastructure consolidation via a BRAC round. But even beyond facilities, I think that there's opportunity to consolidate functions in DoD and really get rid of a lot of overhead. The problem, as was cited in the Washington Post story, and was cited by defense leadership in the Washington Post story, is that the politics around making those decisions and getting rid of that redundancy and moving to a consolidated structure are overwhelming, that politicians in both parties see nothing at all to gain in pursuing that path of consolidation and in getting rid of the overhead, because it takes jobs and footprint out of potentially a lot of congressional districts. Anyway, let me comment on this story a little bit through the lens of some work that we at Avasant had done a little bit earlier this year, which I think in many ways created a foundation that led us to not being surprised by what the Post reported today. We looked earlier this year at the DoD operations and maintenance budget in some detail. This is probably the account that, despite being the largest account in the Department of Defense's budget, it's probably the least understood in a lot of ways because it's so resistant to analysis. Many of our listeners probably know that the O&M budget accounts for about 40% of the total DoD's budget. So it's substantially more than the procurement account, which tends to get a lot more attention. The O&M account pays for almost anything that you can imagine to keep the Department of Defense functional. So civilian salaries and medical care and fuel and IT and network services and a whole raft of other professional and administrative and technical services. Spare parts, training operations are conducted using O&M money. Almost any cost category that you can think of that's not paid for out of the big capital procurement accounts come out of the O&M budget. And it's part of the reason why that account is so large and really drives top-line dynamics in the Defense Department. The analysis that we had done earlier this year took the O&M budget and divided it up in two sort of parallel sets of categories. We divided up the budget by what we called cost categories, and that is, what is the kind of expense that O&M is being used to pay for? And so some cost categories would include some of the items that I just mentioned. So civilian pay and benefits, equipment maintenance, supplies and equipment, medical care, facilities, fuel, and so forth. We also divided up the budget into a series of what we termed capability categories. and we listed six capability categories. So the ones that everybody knows are aviation and land forces and maritime and space. So this is the core operating capabilities for which we have a Defense Department. But also, there's a couple of others that are also noteworthy that, that comprise the total O&M budget. One of those is classified spending. So you can amass and quantify the amount of classified O&M in the DoD budget, but you can't know exactly what it's used for. So classified O&M in the FY17 budget, just to give you a sense of scale, accounts for about $21 billion. But the sixth cost category is the one that's most troublesome, and that is enterprise-wide. So enterprise-wide essentially is the capability category for the department as a whole. You know, just keeping the lights on and business running and creating the foundation from which to actually sustain operating forces. Enterprise-wide is by far the largest capability category in the Department of Defense. And I'll read off some figures here. So enterprise-wide capabilities spending in the FY17 budget, including both base and overseas contingency operations spending, totals about $87 billion. Now, by contrast, the next largest category, which is aviation, accounts for less than $59 billion. So, I mean, you're talking about well over one-third of the DoD O&M budget is just to keep the enterprise functioning before you do anything with the operating forces for which the Department of Defense exists. And so, you know, when we saw that scale, you know, nearly 40% of O&M keeping the lights on, it is really what led us to read the Washington Post story today with open eyes. You know, realize that how much cost it takes just to keep the organization functioning before it does anything for which people know the military for. So with that, let me pause. And Sebastian, I think you could probably take it from here and talk a little bit about one of the things that the Washington Post story went into is if you can really save something on the scale of $125 billion by doing this kind of consolidation and cost savings, what would you do with that money? What if a Trump administration, which has talked a little bit about trying to reform the way the Department of Defense and the federal government as a whole functions, what would you do with the savings? Assuming you were able to accumulate it, where would it go? So, Sebastian, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Matt and I probably have a few thoughts here. But before we get to that, I also wanted to highlight one aspect of the study that you did that struck me anyway as particularly relevant to the Washington Post story, which is that aside from its size, enterprise-wide O&M spending is home to some of the fastest-growing categories of activity as well. So civilian pay and benefits, which you referenced, I think grew by almost 3% between the last year's request and this year's request. That may not be a significant percentage swing, but given the dollar values at stake, it winds up being significant. And the second is IT and network services, which grew at almost 12% and is primarily housed in defense-wide activities. So I would add that as people peruse the Defense Business Board report, it's probably best read as a base scenario that the conditions described in there have probably been exacerbated as time has gone on from the publication of that document.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would build on that. Just say that you know, the largest categories, the fastest growing categories of spending in the O&M account are categories that do not go directly to warfighting capability. You know, so as you said, civilian pay and benefits, IT and network services, and a third I would mention here is medical care. You know, that these are by a notable margin the fastest growing categories in the O&M budget, and they are largely irrelevant to operating forces. And that's unfortunate. But again, if you've read the Washington Post story and absorbed it, this probably comes as no surprise to you.
Well, we'll turn to that subject of operating forces. There is a slide in the report that talks about essentially warfighter currency. And the implication is that every dollar saved from revisions to the processes that result in some kind of efficiency can be applied to some kind of capability. If it's 50 brigades or it's another carrier strike group or more combat air squadrons. But Matt, some of the work that you and I have done over the past couple of months suggests that's not necessarily true, that before the Pentagon can buy new capability, it has to pay for some bills that it hadn't necessarily planned on in putting together the Future Use Defense Plan. Can you talk a little bit about what goes into that?
So we've been looking in the past several months over to sort of what a realistic assessment is to just execute the plans as laid out in the FY17 FYDP. And just getting to the numbers, or the expectations sort of in the FYDP and the 30-year shipbuilding plan will be difficult with the current budget. So to the extent that any savings are probably going to go almost straight towards the actual cost of some of the planned programs. So a relatively sort of easy example of this is the shipbuilding plan, the 30-year shipbuilding plan that the Navy has. Most estimates indicate that on a per-year basis, the Navy is somewhere between $5 and $6 billion a year short of what they'll need to just build the ships that are required to get to a Navy of 308 ships per their plan. That's going to chew up a significant amount of that money. If you're looking to sort of get to actually handle the sort of bow wave of aircraft procurement that the Air Force is facing, that's going to require an additional $6 to $10 billion a year in spending. And O&M almost always comes in as being more expensive than what the department plans. As you can see from this report, there is potential savings there, but their ability to execute on that is questionable at best. So between all that, it makes it hard to see just how much more money there'd be for additional priorities, which would also be more expensive, I think. If you look at the numbers for what it would cost to do some of the things that the sort of President-elect Trump laid out earlier this year, that would be also more expensive than what was expected.
But before you get to any kind of additional capability, you have to pay these bills that come from program overruns, as programs are, particularly in RDT&E, are typically more expensive than the department plans, and this unfunded O&M liability that you described. In our estimation, over the next 5 years, those unpaid bills alone total about $105 billion. So to execute on the plan as it stands now, even if there were to be significant savings from back office functions, most of those would go towards paying existing bills, essentially, before we can begin to buy new capability. The other aspect of this is, I think the report, in my view, is a little bit optimistic on some of the pricing assumptions behind what new capability you could buy, even if you did have $125 billion to spend on new functionality alone. So I know that you and I did an estimate of what it would take to get the Army up to 50 brigades and to start down that path. I think our number was well in excess of $130 billion over the next 5 years just to launch that process, understanding that all of those brigades won't be constituted for some time. And it occurs to me also that the time horizon on the warfighter currency slide there is 5 years, but the O&M costs and the MILPERS costs of constituting new combat units persist far beyond that. So do you think that in the out years there's a potentially compounding budget problem where new combat brigades come online, we make additions to the shipbuilding plan to get up to 350, we pay the unpaid bills, and then we have to essentially carry an O&M and MILPERS burden that is very, very hard to shed? And does that, in your estimation, exceed the resources that can reasonably be available to the Department of Defense over that long time frame?
Well, to reasonable resources probably depends on where you sit. But in terms of how far this $125 billion in five-year spending, or probably a similar number if you stretched out to the 10-year budget horizon that they use when looking at the Hill, you're going to need a lot more money, quite honestly. Even if you were to get every single dollar in savings that the report recommends to execute the plans that sort of laid out by President-elect Trump, which is a 350-ship Navy, additional 87 combat aircraft, and up to 50 ECTs for the Army, plus a plus-up of the Marine Corps, you're looking at significantly more money than $125 billion. I think our total costs are well in excess to that. I'm trying to remember the exact number on that. But you absolutely need to increase the budget by a significant amount just to get to those numbers.
So I think the net-net is that neither savings in back-office functions nor a realistic near-term plus-up of the defense top line is going to go entirely toward new capability. And I think we would also probably say that
it would be very difficult to get to either the 50 Brigade Combat Team, 350 Ship Navy, or 87 additional aircraft simultaneously in the near term, even given both of those things. Would you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. And also, just I think Doug mentioned this earlier, the politics of actually achieving these reductions are extremely fraught, and not in a sort of a Democrat-Republican sense, but more so in a regional and district level and intra-services type sense. There's significant there are reasons why these costs haven't gone away over time, and it's because the forces that want these entities to have contracts are significant.
Right. We will be sure to post the study that we referenced earlier on in this podcast, along with this podcast, and also our contact information. So if our listeners there have any questions or are interested in seeing some of the data that led us to some of these conclusions, we encourage them to contact us. Thank you for your time.
You've been listening to Avacynt on the Record. To learn more about Avacynt, go to avacynt.com or follow us on Twitter at @avacynt.